Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, COVID-19, Led Zeppelin and Katy Perry. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we're going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when...
The world went mad.
Yeah. And as a result, I said I'm with you, or you're with me, but we should make very clear, we are not together.
We are socially distancing each other.
We're not breathing in the same room. we are separated.
Not only are we in different rooms, we're in different places on Earth.
Yes. Same country. I think that's still allowed.
I don't think they've insisted that every individual go and live in a separate country. I'm not sure that would work. But yes, so there's two things to say here, which is we are in different locations. Now, we have done this before on Setlist. It's not the first time.
Have.
I mean, generally with disastrous results.
Oh, yeah, it's been awful when we've done it before. So fingers crossed.
Somewhere in the archive, there is the edition where... And in some ways, that was preparing us for today, wasn't it? Remember that edition when I was at the Edinburgh Festival and all of our technology plans failed? So I ended up recording it on the phone in a cupboard.
In a cupboard.
And
yeah,
then, of course,
forgotten that.
Because I was sort of holding the phone, I don't think I even had headphones, so I was literally talking. Anyway, don't go and find it in the archive. It was unlistenable. But as a result of that, we learned. And so hopefully our setups are now slightly better. Although it has to be said, I live in the lovely London district of Leytonstone in a roof. Mm. And it's funny.
Well, I'm in a roof too.
We're both in a roof. And it's funny how you think you live in a really nice, peaceful part of London, in my case, until you start setting up sound recording equipment. And then you notice just how many bumps and bangs there are. There's some weird, almost drilling noise that I've started to notice since I set this up. I have no idea what it is. There is no drilling going on anywhere in this building or near this building. So, yeah, this is, I suppose, I mean, presumably pretty much every podcast on the internet this week is putting in the disclaimer at the start, which is there may be weird noises going on in the background, motorbikes going past, water flushing through pipes, and there's only so much you can do in the edit on that. So if there's weird noises going on in the background, bear with us, I suppose, is what we're saying.
Yes, I mean, it should be okay. We're like, there's no cupboards this time. We have proper recording equipment, so it should be better than usual.
And neither of us are in Edinburgh, so...
Yeah, which is a big plus.
So, sorry, Edinburgh. I would love to be in Edinburgh right now, but I'm not allowed to leave. Well, you don't really know where you're not allowed to leave, are you? The rules here in the UK at the moment, if you're listening to this from elsewhere in the world, maybe the rules where you live as we record this are much more rigid. But here in the UK, no one's quite sure what the rules are. Maybe I could get the train up to Edinburgh, but...
Well, I don't think there's no law saying you can't. If the trains are running...
They just don't want you to. So as we currently stand, by the time this podcast goes out on Monday morning, we may be in 100% lockdown because things are changing fast. And as a result of that, the music industry is having to respond fast as well. And we're going to spend a big chunk of this edition of Setlist talking about that, aren't we?
Yes, yes, we are. And we also have a bit of non-coronavirus news because there still is some, so we might as well.
Well, no, it's interesting, isn't it? It has sort of felt that since the last proper edition of Setlist went out, what, 2 weeks ago now, so much has changed, and the Daily is getting more and more of the stories in there. An increasing number are somehow linked to the coronavirus, whether that is the impact on the industry or its artists responding to it, etc., etc. It does sort of feel like we're becoming the coronavirus and music update. See, that would work, wouldn't it?
But
the world does carry on, and I sort of feel in the current times... It's important for the world to carry on and for us to think about the other things so your brains don't explode with all of this stuff. So, yeah, there have actually been a couple of pretty interesting copyright developments in the US in the last couple of weeks. So we're going to talk about those as well as all the coronavirus developments within the music community.
Yeah, let's get going with that right away. So, top story this week, coronavirus. There is a coronavirus. It's happening. It's got us all stuck indoors. All we can do now is record podcasts and talk about coronavirus. That's it now.
That is the world we are currently living in.
Although, as I've just said, we do have non-coronavirus stuff coming up. Stay tuned. But now, as you said just now, we did talk about this before a couple of weeks ago. And listening back to the episode now, it seems wonderfully innocent. It's it wasn't even our top story. And we finished it by saying, who knows, this might be the last time we ever talk about this. And I don't think that, well, it definitely isn't the case, because we're talking about it now, but I think it might be the only thing we talk about for quite some time.
Yeah, so 2 weeks ago, when we first started talking about COVID-19, I don't know, had it even been called COVID-19
2 weeks ago?
We were talking about the coronavirus, but at that point, bearing in mind, this is just 2 weeks ago, it all seemed a little bit distant. Obviously, this has been a story that has been rumbling around for months now, with the original outbreaks in China and elsewhere in Asia, and there was a music industry element to that from the off, in that obviously the local music industries in those countries were impacted, and then on a global level, many international artists started postponing and cancelling tour dates in that part of the world. Then 2 weeks ago, when we were talking about it, it still was a little bit distant, in that the main story was events being cancelled in the US and elsewhere in Europe. It hadn't really had a UK dimension to it 2 weeks ago. And indeed, after we recorded that last edition of Setlist, you may remember that we did that in Margate, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
So I came to see you in Margate. That's where we recorded it. And afterwards, I had a meeting in Margate with Annabella, the CEO of the Music Managers Forum. And at that point, when we had that meeting, she was getting ready to head off to Austin for South by Southwest. I was getting ready to head off for a music conference that was happening in India. And at that point, we were genuinely both talking about those trips happening. And
yeah.
That just seems bizarre with hindsight, because actually that evening, and I suppose this was the development that I think from a sort of UK-US perspective really changed everything, was that the organisers of South by Southwest, having previously said that they were going to go ahead and do everything they could to go ahead, on that evening actually, so between us recording that podcast and that podcast going out, the announcement came out, South by Southwest 2020 is not happening. And ever since then, pretty much, festival after festival, show after show, conference after conference have just been cancelling all over the world.
Yeah, so in the UK, the big one obviously is Glastonbury, which announced last week that it was not going to go ahead with its 50th anniversary edition. And I think for a lot of other festivals, that was really the moment that kind of it lit up like a beacon and said, you need to make some sort of decision on what you're doing. Because although one of the reasons Glastonbury cancelled was it takes them 3 months to set up the site with a huge number of people there, which isn't really feasible at the moment. And other festivals don't have quite the same lead time. And while it's really not clear what the situation's going to be like in July and August, I think that has rattled a lot of people, because, I mean, there's that and there's Eurovision as well. These are big events that people didn't really expect to be disappearing suddenly overnight, especially when it's, like I say, Glastonbury's 50th anniversary. It was a big show. And they had lots of stuff planned, and now it's just cancelled.
Yeah, and I suppose from our perspective, as we've been reporting on this, it's interesting because obviously we went quite big on South by cancelling and on Glastonbury cancelling, on Eurovision cancelling, and you could say, well, hang on a second, why are you picking out, you know, those three events? When actually in the last couple of weeks and in the last few months, if we go truly global, so many festivals and events have been cancelled. It's too many for us to be reporting on a daily basis. So why are we honing in on these events? But I think it's because, you know, from a music industry perspective, and particularly a UK music industry perspective, as that's obviously where we are based ourselves, those are the big events. I mean, South By is such a big event within the music industry, particularly for those people working with newer artists. Glastonbury is the uber festival here in the UK. It's the big festival that sort of, I mean, it doesn't kick off the festival season. There are other sort of field-based festivals before Glastonbury, but it always feels like it's Glastonbury weekend when the mainstream media all start talking about music festivals. And of course, Eurovision is an event that cuts across the entirety of the continent and beyond. So it does feel like those events in particular cancelling are big. And as you say, yeah, I mean, Glastonbury is a little bit in the distance, really. I mean, obviously, okay, June isn't that far away. But, I mean, before all of that happened, the big live music companies globally, so Live Nation and AEG on the sort of the venue promoter side, and then many of the big global US-based booking agencies, I mean, they all put out a joint statement as all of this was escalating, saying that they were recommending that all large-scale events, so big festivals and sort of bigger theatre and arena and stadium shows should all be called off to the end of March, is what their statement said. So they were basically saying, yeah, we should pause everything for this month. But then the question is, but are we just talking about a few weeks, or are we talking a few months? And it's increasingly looking like we are talking a few months. Things probably won't be back to normal by the time Glastonbury is happening in June. Now, I mean, as you've already said, actually what they said when they cancelled was, it's not that we're saying things will be back to normal by June. What we're saying is, this is such a big event, we basically have to build a city in a field, and that involves lots of people being in one place at one time. So even if everything is back to normal by June, we can't get everything built in time. So it wasn't that they were saying, we think this is going to be at least a 3-month limbo for the live music industry. That's not what Glastonbury was saying, but it has to be said, it is increasingly looking likely that we are talking at least 3 months of everything being on pause. But I suppose that's part of the frustration, isn't it, for everybody in the music industry. And it's no one's fault that this is the case, but we just don't know. Are we talking about a few week pause, a few month pause? I mean, there are some scientists who are talking about 12 to 18 months before we can return to normal. And that insecurity, that just not knowing, it just makes everything that much worse.
Yes, and I mean, it's the live industry that's really been hit first by this, because as well as festivals starting to cancel, touring has really ground to a halt. Kind of, and similarly, over a period of a couple of weeks, you saw bands start to cancel tours in Asia, and touring's basically stopped now that we've gone into a more serious lockdown. And that has an immediate financial impact, not only on the companies that put on these tours, but the artists who are playing, obviously, and all the behind the scenes crew, most of whom will be freelance contractors who suddenly have no income.
Yeah, so what that means is, really quickly, you know, within the matter of days, you had a significant number of people within the wider music community, you know, artists up to a certain level, and then all the people involved in those artist shows and their managers and their agents. These are people who are operating in a bit of the music industry where two things are key. First of all, that live is the absolute key revenue stream. So although these people will be making or sharing in maybe money from streaming and from sync and from money that comes through the creative licensing system, live is absolutely key to their businesses. So for live to disappear overnight is really, really damaging. And perhaps more importantly, a significant number of these people, I mean, as you say, a lot of them are freelancers, they're self-employed. So it's not a case that although events are off, they're still getting their salary at the end of the month and it's the company's problem. For many, many of these people, they are not getting paid anymore. They're overnight, they've lost all of their business. And of course, the thing about the music community is a significant portion of the music community doesn't really have spare cash flow in the bank, because a lot of people up to a certain level in the business are just about making enough money to live off their music, whether they are artists, whether they're working in live, whether they're managers, agents, etc. But they're not making enough to have a surplus in the bank account. So it means that when this key revenue stream just disappears overnight, and not only are they losing the revenue stream, in some cases they'd already spent money preparing for these shows, they bought airline tickets, they booked into hotels, they'd spent money on promotion, which they're not going to get back. And I mean, obviously there's a whole big debate as to what extent the music industry is insured for any of this, and to what extent the insurance companies will seek to not have to pay out on events that are cancelled because of COVID-19. But I mean, even if the insurance companies all play ball and everyone who is insured gets their insurance money, A, that's not going to happen overnight, and B, actually, the vast majority of the people we're talking about, they won't have insurance. And, you know, and I think it's interesting, isn't it, that it just demonstrates to the wider world that while within the music industry, there are artists, there are individuals, there are companies that bring in huge sums of money with their music and therefore make lots of profits and are sitting on lots of cash reserves, a significant number of people in the music industry, higher up the artist hierarchy than I think most people realise, really are operating on a month-by-month basis, and I just do not have the cash reserves in place to deal with something like this, which is why a big part of the conversation in the music industry worldwide, and especially here in the UK, is that within the space of days, all the various different trade organisations and charities and societies that support the music community have come together and are saying to, certainly here in the UK, a government that has prioritised supporting employees and supporting companies who have employees, and a lot of the economic measures that we've seen in the last 7 days in the UK, that has been the focus, keeping businesses in business, allowing companies that have lots of people who are either off ill or they can no longer work because whatever the business is, in essence, is in temporary shutdown. It's allowing those businesses to not go bankrupt, allowing those businesses to keep paying their employees, which it is a good move, and some of the music industry will benefit from that, but a huge portion of the music industry, that's no help, because these people are self-employed, they're freelance, they rely on invoicing for stuff, they rely on selling stuff directly to their fans, and that money's disappeared overnight. These people need supporting too, and it has to be said, in some parts of Europe, governments have responded to that, but it has to be said here in the UK, so far, as we record this, This may well change because we're obviously getting daily announcements now from the government. Maybe Monday night's announcement will be focused on this. But as it currently stands, very little support has been announced that benefits the self-employed and the freelancers. And that in the main is the bit of the music community that has been almost immediately overnight hit by all of this.
So as last week went on, a number of the music sector's trade organisations co-signed a letter urging the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, to instigate specific measures to support the large number of freelancers and self-employed people working in music. Those organisations were UK Music, ISM, Help Musicians, the MU, MMF, the Ivers Academy and the Music Producers Guild. And they all pointed out that while there had been some economic support measures put in place earlier in the week, such as loans and grants and cuts to business rates, although those help some music companies, it really wasn't helping the freelancers and the self-employed people working in music.
Yeah, and the open letter from those organisations stated that COVID-19 is having a dramatic impact on the workforce of the music sector, particularly those who are self-employed. From live performers to peripatetic music teachers, composers, managers, engineers and producers, their work has come to an end overnight. The letter pointed out that some governments in other countries like Italy, Ireland and Norway and Canada have all recognised this and already put some measures in place to support freelancers and the self-employed, and they basically were calling on the UK government to do likewise.
So on Friday night there was an announcement on support for workers rather than companies, although there has been criticism of that, particularly the discrepancy between employed staff and freelancers. So if you're an employee of a company and you're unable to work, the government will now cover 80% of your salary up to, I think, a maximum of £2,500 in a month. But for freelancers, they've changed the universal credit system so that you can basically apply for the equivalent of statutory sick pay, which is £94.25 a week. And so obviously the difference in income, depending on how you're employed, is quite vast. There is support for covering rent as well in addition to that, but things aren't as clear cut for freelancers and certainly aren't as significant as if you are an employee of a company.
Some of those trade organisations that have been calling for better measures for freelancers responded to Friday night's announcement from the government being quite critical. So the current boss of UK Music, Tom Keel, said that while we welcome the much needed help for those who are traditionally employed, the government proposals fall far short of the lifeline needed by the self-employed in the music industry and the wider creative sector. And therefore, the government should urgently look at setting up a temporary income protection fund for self-employed workers and freelancers. He then noted that the self-employed make up around 72% of the music industry and a vital part of its success, hence why this has become such a big issue and campaigning point for the music community and its trade organisations.
Yeah, and AIM CEO Paul Pacifico also put out a statement on Friday night saying that while AIM welcomed the measures that had been announced, today we are urging the Chancellor, Rishi, please do not wash your hands of the self-employed. The UK economy benefits substantially from over 5 million self-employed and freelance workers who also make up a massive 70% of the UK music industry. Many have lost all sources of income completely through this crisis, have been effectively overlooked and are now facing economic strife as a result. We are calling on the government to extend the same support as payroll employees have been promised, a lifeline to compensate self-employed workers with up to 80% of their average earnings over the past 3 years, if necessary with a cap of £2,500 a month. This could be as easily administered by HMRC as it will be for payroll employees. The self-employed have the same bills to pay as the rest of the nation's workers and contribute just as much. They deserve the same support.
So it remains to be seen if and when the UK government responds to all of these concerns. As we say, we are now getting these daily announcements, and certainly the music industry is going to keep on putting the pressure on. So we wait to see. And I suppose it's important to acknowledge, although we talked about how the people who had the most immediate impact, negative impact as a result of all of this, were those in the live side. So both the performing artists and then the venues and the crews and the managers and the agents, everybody involved in live music. But it's important to note that it's not just the live sector who are being hit, and because everything is moving so rapidly at the moment, although the live industry was first to be hit, the other people are hit days later, because I mean that's how rapidly things are progressing. So for example, on the high street, obviously, although here in the UK shops haven't been told that they have to close as yet, sales are massively down on the high street, which affects retails. The entertainment retailers are being affected by this. As a result of that, physical product, anybody involved in the pressing and distribution of physical product, they're going to be negatively impacted. But then there are other things as well. I mean, for example, the TV and film industry has pretty much gone into shutdown. People aren't making television programmes or films at the moment. Now, if that happens for a couple of weeks, then that probably won't have that big an impact on the music industry. But if it goes on for months, then things like the people who are composing music for those TV programmes and those movies, and everybody in the sync sector, they start to get affected. And of course, there are other bits of music industry, education. There are many, many musicians who part of their life is teaching, you know, and to what extent can that continue? People are experimenting with delivering music tuition online, but I mean, you know, lots of people in the education side will be impacted. The sheet music business will be impacted. Things like merchandise, on one level, merch sales are going up because there's a big director fan initiative going on at the moment, but a big chunk of merch sales are actually linked to live, aren't they? The merch stall at live shows are an important part. So although it begins with the artists who have shows cancelled and everybody involved in delivering those shows, it quite quickly creeps its way across the wider music industry. And as those stats that we've just heard, 70-72% of the wider industry are freelancers, they are contractors, they are the self-employed, and the more this goes on, the more people are going to be impacted. And as we started out by saying, the big unknown is, we don't know, are we talking about a few weeks of shutdown, or are we talking a few months? Could it be the autumn before things get back to normal? Could it be a whole year before things get back to normal? Nobody knows, except the one thing we do know is the longer this goes on, more people are going to be negatively hit. And that is why the UK government, but then this obviously applies to governments all over, some governments have done more to help freelancers and specifically the creative industry in the US. Obviously, it's complicated in the US because some of this is happening at a state level, some of it is happening at a federal level. But in America, the creative industry are likewise rallying and going to Congress and Washington and pointing out all of these music-specific issues. But it will be really interesting to see how things develop in the next 7 days here in the UK and everywhere else in the world.
While the music industry waits to see if hopefully things become a bit clearer about the future in the coming weeks, there are artists and other people who are getting things moving, experimenting with live streaming and donations and other ways of doing things when you can't go outside. And so that's been interesting to see. Obviously, live streaming isn't a new technology, but it really is starting to come into its own now that it's an absolute necessity in many ways.
Yeah, and in terms of the long-term effects of all of this, I mean, hopefully we won't have a live industry in shutdown for too long. But I suppose, you know, one of the positives will be, I mean, as you say, I mean, live streaming technology has been there for some time. Some artists, some brands have done lots of stuff in that space, but it sort of feels that live streaming has never really properly taken off in a mainstream way, certainly not monetized. So some people use live streaming as a promotional tool, but not as a way of making money. And as we start to see artists by necessity getting online, I mean, either just to sort of keep the fan relationship going, just so they have a place that they can be creative and reach out to their fans, but also, can we make money? Now, whether that's by charging people to access the live stream or having a sort of GoFundMe, Kickstarter or Patreon element to it, or just using it to sell merchandise or other director fan stuff. Obviously, a lot of focus has fallen on things like Bandcamp. It will be interesting to see how artists and their business partners experiment with all of this in the coming weeks, to what extent it helps these people get the short-term income that they need while we're waiting for government to sort things out. But as I say, what will be really interesting is, once all of this is over, will we see more live streaming? Will we see director fan, which, again, not a new thing, but it does sort of feel like the industry has never yet truly capitalised on the potential for director fan. It may be that at the end of this, live streaming and director fan will really have come of age and become a much more significant part of the music industry long term, which will be a good thing. In the short term, it's about getting money to artists while we're waiting for governments to catch up. But it may be that in the long term, these become much more stable revenue streams for artists, and actually that would be a positive outcome of all of this negativity and trauma.
So obviously this is a rapidly changing situation, so stay tuned to your CMU Daily. So go to cmusignup.com if you are not already subscribed to receive our daily news bulletins via email. We will be writing daily about what's going on because there's not much else to write about. And so we'll keep you up to date with everything that's currently happening. The organisations who wrote that letter calling on the government for more action for freelancers that we discussed just now have also set up a website with more information for people working in the music industry about what support is out there and other information. So you can find that at coronamusicians.info, and keep checking that too. And hopefully we'll have some more clarity on everything soon. And finally this week, not everything has ground to a halt. Lawyers are still working, and that's good for us because everyone knows we like two things, copyright and lawsuits, preferably together. And we've had two rulings on song theft lawsuits this week that have been quite interesting in the cases against Led Zeppelin and Katy Perry.
Yes, as these were two of the big song theft lawsuits that have been working their way through the American courts in recent years, both sort of in the wake of the Blurred Lines litigation, obviously the big legal battle between Robin Thicke, Pharrell Williams and Marvin Gaye. In that case, it was decided that because there were certain elements between Blurred Lines and the Marvin Gaye track, Got to Give It Up, in common, that was copyright infringement, and obviously mega damages were awarded to the Marvin Gaye estate. Many people in the music and songwriter community felt that that was the wrong judgment. They felt that many pop songs have certain musical elements in common, and the copyright was not intended to protect those musical elements, and that the Blurred Lines judgment set a dangerous precedent. And I think we have seen an escalation of these kinds of cases where you have an old artist, an old songwriter who pops out of the woodwork when a newer artist has had a hit record and says that new record has certain elements in it which are the same as the record I released 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 50 years ago, and that's copyright infringement, so I should get mega bucks damages. And the reason why the Led Zeppelin and the Katy Perry cases are interesting is because obviously these are big name artists, they're big cases which are sort of reviewing many of the same issues as the Blurred Lines case, and therefore the question is, has a precedent been set that's going to be enforced in both of these cases? Or will we get clarification in these cases that actually what seems like a big clear precedent in the Blurred Lines case isn't as clear-cut as some people would think? And it has to be said, we've had significant rulings in both the Led Zeppelin and the Katy Perry case in the last 10 days, and they both seem to be constraining this principle, where you have two songs that have certain elements in common, but only those certain elements in common. We're starting to see the courts say, judges, whereas some of those early judgments were jury judgments, we're starting to see judges say, no, if you've just got some common musical elements in common, that isn't copyright infringement, and we need to start constraining these cases. So the Led Zeppelin case, I mean, actually, this wasn't a older songwriter taking on a newer songwriter, because I mean, these are both very old records, obviously, but Led Zeppelin were accused of ripping off an earlier track called Taurus by a band called Spirit, written by a guy called Randy Wolf. It's the Randy Wolf estate. He's no longer with us. It's an estate that has sued on this, basically saying that Led Zeppelin took some segments of Taurus and put it into Stairway into Heaven, that's copyright infringement. Actually, when this case originally went before a jury, the jury decided that the two songs weren't similar enough. Although there were clearly some elements in common, those similarities were not strong enough to constitute copyright infringement. The Wolf estate then appealed, and first time round in the Ninth Circuit Appeals Court in the US, the appeals court decided that some of the instructions that had been given to the jury first time round were not appropriate, and therefore there was grounds to basically set aside that jury judgment and have a second trial. So that's what the Ninth Circuit said first time round. But then the Ninth Circuit decided that they wanted to listen to the case for a second time, this time en banc, as they say, which basically means more judges are involved. And that was based on the argument that actually there are some really important copyright principles being tested in this dispute, and therefore it should go before a bigger panel of judges. And this time round, the judges decided to keep the lower court judgment, that original jury decision, in place, and saying actually the instructions the judge gave to the jury were correct. There was various things that the Wolf estate felt that the judge should have allowed in the original case. For example, they argued they should have allowed the recorded versions of these songs to be played in court. They hadn't done that for various reasons. But this time round, the Ninth Circuit said, no, actually, everything that happened first time round was appropriate, and therefore that original jury ruling that there is not a case for copyright infringement between Taurus and Stairway to Heaven, even though there are certain musical components in common, that judgment should stand. And to an extent, that seems to be constricting slightly the precedent that was set in the Blurred Lines case. And interestingly, the Katy Perry Dark Horse case, which was already working its way through the appeals courts, already had some sessions in the appeals court in the diary before we got the Ninth Circuit ruling on Stairway to Heaven. Judges in that case immediately said, this Ninth Circuit ruling, that enhances our case for overturning last year's ruling in the Katy Perry Dark Horse song theft case, in which in that scenario the jury decided that there was Blurred Line style a case for copyright infringement because you had two songs that had some common elements in them.
Yes, so in the Dark Horse case, it was Katy Perry was accused of using a melody that had been previously used by a Christian rapper called Flame in his song Joyful Noise. And it was decided by a jury that the similarity was close enough and ordered Perry to pay $2.7 million in damages to Flame. The Katy Perry side appealed and carried on with the same arguments that they had put forward in the original trial. It was that melody was a very simple melody. It was used in lots of different pieces of music throughout history, and it was basically just a building block of music that was just kind of a starting point for building a bigger song on top of, and therefore could not be copyrighted. And once the Led Zeppelin ruling came in earlier this month and they had their next hearing lined up just days later, they really started putting forward the argument that the Led Zeppelin ruling supported their case.
Yeah, in an oral hearing early last week in the Dark Horse case, Katy Perry's lawyers cited what had happened a week earlier in the Stairway to Heaven judgment in the Ninth Circuit, and they said that the appeals judges in the Stairway case had provided an extended defence of why copyright law doesn't cover common musical elements and basic building blocks, because doing so might curtail the creations of new works. And that argument, enforced by that very recent Ninth Circuit decision, helped Katy Perry to get the big Dark Horse judgment over. Returned on appeal. The other side, the Joyful Noise side, had argued that while it may be true that the elements in common between the two songs were common musical segments, they said, aha, but yes, while the musical segments may be common, the way in which they have been employed is original, and therefore that should be protected by copyright, which is a sort of interesting technicality. But the appeals judge in the Dark Horse case said, no, I don't think the way you've used these different musical segments are in themselves original enough to be protected by copyright, and then listed some other songs where a very similar use of those musical segments can be found. So not only are the musical segments common, but the way in which those musical segments have been employed is also quite common, was basically the appeals court ruling. So the entire judgment was set aside. So two rulings coming within pretty much a week of each other that seem to be constraining this principle under American copyright law regarding songs that have certain elements in common. Is there a case for copyright infringement? In the Blurred Lines case there was, but now we've got two judgments saying, let's not get carried away with that. Let's not try to employ copyright technicality to find infringement that isn't really there. So I think those people in the music and songwriter community who were concerned by the precedent of the Blurred Lines judgment will be pleased with these developments in both the Stairway to Heaven and the Dark Horse case. Although it has to be said, neither of those disputes are as yet at their end. There is further routes of appeal for both the Wolf Estate on the Stairway to Heaven case and for Flame's legal team on the Joyful Noise case. The latter have already said that they plan to appeal the appeal judgment, and the Wolf Estate said that they were reviewing their options but indicated that further legal action was probably going to happen. So I don't think either of these cases are at their end, but interesting judgments which potentially are giving us a little bit of clarity on the whole song theft thing. And as I say, a lot of people in the music community who were concerned by the precedent set in the Blurred Lines case will be pleased that we've had these two judgments so close together that seem to be constraining that principle.
So those stories are ongoing, as with all the COVID-19 stuff, so we may have more reports on those in the CMU Daily as well. Once again, CMUsignup.com if you want to get our daily news bulletins straight to your inbox. But that is all we've got time for on Setlist this week, not least because I have not got very long to edit this now before it all immediately goes out of date. So I better get on with that. But in the meantime, you can subscribe to Setlist in your podcast app of choice, and you can contact us about anything we've discussed in the show if you have any questions or comments at setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Setlist is an Unlimited production.